Dominic, do you want to hear a really good joke from my 2-year-old niece, Sophie?
Oh, yes, I love 2-year-old humour.
Okay, here it is.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Europe.
Europe. Europe who?
I'm not a poo.
I love how she says Europe. Europe.
Europe. Thank you very much, Sophie. It's good to know that we have yet another comic genius in the family.
Another comic genius and a lover of Europe, by the sounds of things.
Supposedly, yeah. How are you doing?
I'm fine. I'm very excited to be getting vaccinated tomorrow.
Me too!
It's wild. And one of our producers is getting vaccinated tomorrow as well. It's really weird. It's like they went down the list of like people in their 60s, people in their 50s, podcasters.
Vaccination day at the Europeans. How are you feeling about it?
I'm pretty excited about it, although I also feel a bit weird and icky, like being excited about it on a podcast, considering that there are like loads of people around the world who are nowhere near getting a vaccine. So it feels, yeah, like I'm very privileged.
I'm going to give some money to COVAX. Not that it makes the situation any better, but it will alleviate my personal guilt very slightly. You can actually donate personally to COVAX. I'm going to put the link in the show notes.
That's a very good idea. And have you decided what you're going to wear?
I haven't, but I think we should wear something jazzy.
Oh, I'm thinking of going like full European male politician and wearing a really inconvenient shirt that means I have to take my entire shirt off and get someone to take a photo.
Oh no, here are my pecs.
Yeah, which pecs?
Well, that's very exciting. But what have we got coming up in the show this week?
Coming up on this week's show, we are going to be talking about the Cyrillic alphabet, because next Monday is a national holiday in a few Eastern European countries, the Day of the Cyrillic Alphabet, celebrating the work, or maybe not just the work, of the brothers Cyril and Methodius, who maybe developed the Cyrillic alphabet in the First Bulgarian Empire with the bit of help from their students.
Cyril and Methodius sound like a pair of DJs.
Or the alternative Mario Brothers from the 9th century. Yeah. Anyway, this week we'll be joined by two designers and lovers of Cyrillic, Maria Doreuli from Russia and Krista Radueva from Bulgaria. Together they run a project where they share their love of Cyrillic and explain details about it for other designers around the world. So we're excited to chat to them later and find out more about this alphabet that is estimated to be used by about 250 million people around the world. Before we go on, I just wanted to say that we have decided not to discuss the conflict in the Middle East this week. It felt like we weren't the right people to give you up-to-date analysis of what's clearly a horrible, terrifying, and deadly situation. Please do all nonetheless go and read up on what is happening, educate yourselves, donate to causes like Médecins Sans Frontières if you've got any spare cash. And we will find a way to discuss this conflict in a future episode. We're currently searching for someone to come and talk to us about the British mandate of Palestine and some of the history. If anyone has any good ideas, send us an email, hello@europeanspodcast.com. Who has had a good week, Katie?
It's been a good week for the residents of Paris, my own city, and that is because of a rather eye-catching plan by the socialist mayor, Anne Hidalgo, to ban most cars from the city centre, leaving the roads mostly for use by bicycles and public transport. It's a pretty obvious idea. Less cars in the middle of town would make it less polluted, which would be good, because Paris is one of the most polluted cities in Europe. There was actually a Finnish study last year that, in fact, ranked Paris as the European city with the worst air quality, which is lovely.
Did they rank themselves really well? Were they like, all the Finnish cities are great?
We're amazing. Funny that. But yeah, it's clear that something needs to be done in Paris. And this new plan, it wouldn't ban cars altogether, but basically you wouldn't be allowed to drive into the city centre unless you fell into one of a few different categories. Like, you are a resident in the city centre, so that's where your car is parked. Or you're driving to a hotel, or you are delivering something. There's actually quite a few categories of people that would still be allowed to drive into central Paris in cars. And it's still up for debate whether these rules should apply to motorbikes, which are a really big source of pollution in Paris. I say this as someone who is frequently the recipient of their fumes in my face when I'm waiting at the traffic lights with my bike.
I thought you were going to say, while I'm queuing outside the patisserie for my croissant. Come on, give it some more Parisian colour, Katie.
Waiting at traffic lights is Parisian colour. That's all we do.
Okay, so it sounds like it's not actually that radical. I mean, there are other cities around Europe who have done similar things, aren't there?
Yeah, exactly. Paris is certainly not the first European city to try something like this out. Madrid is one really good example. There was this initiative called Madrid Central, which banned more polluting models of cars from part of the city centre. But that project has actually just suffered a Supreme Court ruling against it over the past week, and it's not really clear what's going to happen to it now. There's been loads of different types of initiative in European cities aimed at dissuading car journeys in general. Congestion fees are a really good example. So in cities like London and Milan, you have to pay a fee if you want to drive through the city centre. And that is obviously one way of incentivising people to use public transport instead. In Paris, the idea is mainly to target a quite specific group, which is people who drive through the city centre without stopping on their way to the other side of town, which is apparently 55% of total traffic on an average day, like 100,000 cars. So quite a lot of people. And I just think it's crazy that so many people do this because central Paris is a traffic disaster. I used to know this guy who was obsessed with driving everywhere. Hello, Alexandre, if you're listening. And we would get into his car to drive to a restaurant 15 minutes away and then sit in traffic for like half an hour and have loads of trouble finding a parking space. Like, it was so stupid. Paris is a way quicker city to navigate by bike or public transport than car. So it's quite surprising how many people attempt to drive through the middle of the city in individual cars every day, when you would think that in many cases, if you really do need a car, like you're transporting, I don't know, like a bunch of children or a large object, it's often quicker to drive out of the city and around the edges.
Although driving around the edges of Paris can also be pretty stressful. I say that from experience.
That's true. It's not the easiest city to navigate by a car in general. It's very, like, bad for blood pressure. But yeah, I'm not really sure who all these people are making these trips across the centre of town, because it seems to be not primarily commuters from the suburbs. According to City Hall, this would actually cut down traffic in the city centre by quite a decent chunk, potentially tens of thousands of journeys every day, as early as next year, which feels quite soon. You know, often when these plans get announced, it's like, in 2092, we're going to do this. But if it gets approved, then this is going to happen, yeah, soon. Apparently, the mayor is quite motivated to keep alive one of the few good things from the pandemic, which is this new cycling culture that has developed in Paris. It's pretty noticeable. There's definitely way more people riding bikes regularly than there were when I first moved to Paris 6 years ago.
But you always cycled in Paris. I always assumed it was always quite a cycly city.
Just really ahead of the curve, Dominic. What can I say? It wasn't previously anything like, you know, it's not a cycling city in the way that Amsterdam is, for example. And it still isn't.
I mean, which cities are?
Exactly, that's true. But there was a bit of a cycling craze about 2 years ago when there were these massive train strikes and people were suddenly forced to find a different way to get to work. So it kind of predates the pandemic a little bit. But then with coronavirus, even more people were obviously reluctant to pack onto the metro every day and they started biking around. So there's really been quite a visible culture change. Even just at my office, they've had to put in twice as much bike storage as there was a couple of years ago. And this cultural change was something that the mayor, Anne Hidalgo, was really happy about. She's always been very pro-bike. There's like subsidies for buying electric bikes and things like that. And during the pandemic, she brought in 50 kilometers worth of new bike lanes, which were supposed to be temporary. But then she decided, you know what? Let's make them permanent. People seem to like them.
That's great.
It is.
But I know from experience in Amsterdam that where we've also got a green local council who are making some decisions like this, that these decisions are often very popular with the cyclists and people who walk a lot, but not so popular with drivers. Is she losing support because of this?
Well, I mean, car people already hate the mayor of Paris. She's been embroiled in a much longer term war with them. They actually published her direct phone number a few years ago.
Ooh.
Yeah, and ran this campaign encouraging car users to like ring up her office and tell her that she'd made their life hell, which gives you a bit of a flavour of how much animosity there is. One of the biggest things that Anne Hidalgo has done that has been really unpopular with some people is that she pedestrianised the riverbanks, the banks of the Seine, a few years ago. And it has become an absolutely lovely place to take a stroll. It is so much nicer than it was. But the car users all complain that this hasn't really reduced traffic. It's actually just pushed the cars into the adjoining streets. So now they're super polluted and gridlocked all the time. And sadly, that is kind of true. This was a great initiative that has created a lovely, lovely pedestrian experience. But it didn't actually bring down the number of cars. It just crammed them into a smaller number of roads. And actually, some of the critics of this plan think there is a risk of this plan potentially turning into a bigger version of that, whereby you can't drive through the city centre, but there's not actually fewer cars trying to get around. So the cars will just cram into areas on the edges of the no-car zone, like my neighbourhood, which wouldn't be that fun. So what we really need to do is bring down the actual number of cars.
I don't really buy that entirely. From the way you described it earlier, it sounds like some people will end up not using their car for short journeys, like your friend Alexandre.
Exactly. So hopefully this new plan will go some way in dissuading people, like Alexandre, from like hopping in the car for a journey he can make using the metro. But it does feel also like City Hall just needs to pour loads of resources into making public transport better, including for commuters in the suburbs, because they're also a really big source of the car traffic in the city. And I'm sure if Mayor Anne was here right now, she would say that she is doing that simultaneously. This whole thing is still just a plan. It isn't definitely going to happen. And there's just been a public consultation launched about how it would work. But it seems pretty likely to go ahead. Anne Hidalgo won re-election at City Hall very comfortably last year. And she is leading this left-wing coalition that includes the Greens. So they've got a pretty strong mandate to push through exactly this kind of policy. So we might well see it coming into force by next year. Watch this space.
Meanwhile, isn't she considering running for president?
Yeah, she's considering it. So she's keeping her cards close to her chest for now. She says she's going to make a decision this autumn about whether or not to actually run for the presidency next year. And I have to confess, it doesn't feel like that many people, even on the left, are like wildly excited about the idea of her running for president. Even in polls of exclusively left-wing voters, only about a third say that they'd vote for her. She definitely has an image as someone who represents the sort of like metropolitan, latte drinking, bicycle riding centre-left, like the more anti-system leftist people, the kind of people who join the Gilets Jaunes protests and they don't live in big cities and they really hate this idea of the Parisian elite. It's hard to imagine those kind of people voting for her, even though she has really this quite traditional left-wing background. She grew up in a working-class neighbourhood of Lyon. Her parents were Spanish immigrants. She worked in labour law. And it feels like this kind of lack of an obvious candidate on the left, it is definitely indicative of this bigger crisis in the French left, where it doesn't really know what it is. The Socialist Party, her party, it used to hold together all these different wings of the left under one big banner. And it just doesn't really feel like they're managing to do that anymore. Which is not obviously a situation that's unique to France, of course. It's something that we've seen in other countries.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah. So we will see whether Anne Hidalgo decides to run in the autumn and try and be like the saviour of the French left. But I kind of feel like we shouldn't discount her just yet. One thing that's really interesting about her is she's actually got a pretty good track record of building coalitions between different parties on the left, including the communists. So she might still have a few tricks up her sleeve. You never know.
Mm-hmm.
Who's had a bad week?
The Slovenian Prime Minister, Janez Janša. He got himself into a pickle with his reported choice of panther cufflinks as the official diplomatic gift for visitors during the upcoming Slovenian presidency of the Council of the EU.
I quite like the idea of having some panther cufflinks. I think they sound jazzy. What's wrong with it?
Sure. Well, you can enjoy them aesthetically, but it's about the background behind this panther symbol. And it's become quite a divisive symbol in Slovenia. Some, like Janša, see it as an ancient symbol of the Carantanian Principality, which was a Slavic principality that emerged in the 7th century and existed mainly in the south of modern-day Austria, but it may have also included a small bit of modern-day Slovenia. And even though Carantania mainly existed on the land of another country, this supposedly Carantanian panther symbol nonetheless has become very popular in Slovenia amongst populist nationalists who seem to want to create a feeling of the past glory of Slovenia. And the reason why Janša is in a pickle over this choice is not just because it's a symbol of right-wing nationalism, but because historians have been fact-checking this supposedly historical symbol and have pointed out that the use of the panther as a symbol for Carantania is actually a modern invention. It is not a 7th century symbol, but it was apparently invented by a historical enthusiast called Josko Savli about 4 decades ago.
So it doesn't quite have the ancient credentials that some people have been pitching it as having.
No, exactly. And the historians are up in arms that this panther is being proposed as an official symbol for the country during this pretty important EU presidency.
So is this the first time that anyone's trying to use this panther as like an actual official symbol of Slovenia?
Well, no. It is used by the army already sometimes, though not on uniforms. And we already knew that Janša is a big fan of the panther. He's been spotted wearing a pin with the symbol on it. And actually, he even wrote a book whilst in prison called The White Panther.
Oh, that sounds fun. Potential isolation inspiration, maybe?
I'm not sure about that.
But sorry, hold up. He was in prison?
Yeah, he was in prison in 2014 due to corruption charges, which the Constitutional Court eventually threw out and a retrial never happened. It was just after his second stint at being prime minister. He's now on his third stint. But anyway, he wrote a book called The White Panther, and I'm sorry to say that I didn't read it in preparation for this segment, but a much more dedicated journalist at The Economist took one for the team and read it. They described it as a novel about brave proto-Slovene warriors and their sexy maidens defending their homeland from marauding eastern tribes two millennia ago.
Wow. There's a lot going on there.
Yeah, I really don't think this is going to make it into isolation inspiration. But it sounds like it kind of ties into this populist nationalist trope of creating a mythical sense of national greatness. And this populism is working to some extent. Janša is in power again, albeit with a very slim majority. But the panther imagery is becoming pretty divisive and is something that a significant proportion of the population already don't feel attached to. And I wonder how this criticism of it being a fictional historical image will affect people's feelings about Janša and about the imagery. Surely some people will now think twice about it. It doesn't, however, seem like Janša himself is going to back down. He posted a video of a black panther on Twitter with one of the independent television stations that he's critical of tagged. It was a bit of a weird tweet.
He has really like filled the void left by Trump on this side of the Atlantic, at least, in terms of being like the populist leader who tweets stupid things and then people write news articles about it.
Yeah, it's very true. And actually, this brings me to a point that he is doing much more alarming things than choosing a panther symbol for his cufflinks at the moment. That's an understatement. He indeed has kind of taken on this Trump-like or Orban-like attacks on the independent media in Slovenia. And some are worried that Slovenia is moving towards becoming another illiberal democracy for Europe following the anti-democratic shifts of Hungary and Poland. And as it would happen, Janša is pretty good pals with Hungarian PM Viktor Orban. Due to this context, some in the EU are a bit nervous about Janša taking over the rotating council of the EU presidency in July.
Can you just give us a quick reminder, how does the presidency thing work again?
Sure. The presidency of the Council of the EU is a position that rotates between different countries every 6 months. Currently, Portugal are holding the position and they'll be passing it over to Slovenia in July. The country holding the presidency gets to chair meetings, preferably neutrally, but they can also set goals and priorities for the bloc during their presidency. So there is some power that's not insignificant. And you can understand why some EU diplomats have been quoted as being nervous about having Slovenia as president at the moment. Janez Janša has some pretty out there populist tendencies, and like he supports conspiracy theories about Trump winning the 2020 election, for example, and has been moving steadily rightwards. And whilst his diplomats have been seemingly trying to downplay these concerns and paint themselves as more moderate, this kerfuffle about the cufflinks with a mythical nationalist symbol on them will probably not be helping to calm any of those nerves. But before we move on to something less silly than a pair of cufflinks, I should say that the cufflinks have not been 100% confirmed by the Slovenian diplomatic mission to the EU. They gave a statement to Politico saying that the procurement procedures are still ongoing and that the selected gifts will be going public in June. So we'll have to wait to see whether the panthers disappear or not. But for now, bad week for Janez Janša, who has been exposed publicly for not knowing his history and for using a powerful big cat to try and make himself appear bigger and more powerful. That last bit's not a fact, it's just my basic pop psychology reading.
Several weeks after I complained on this podcast that you have been removing my exclamation marks, Dominic, from our thank you emails to new Patreon supporters, I am still getting messages of support from people who are pro exclamation marks. So I think we should bring them back in. I don't think they make us look unhinged. I think they look enthusiastic.
I noticed that you took out a few of the exclamation marks and just replaced them with smiley faces.
Yes, I wondered if you'd noticed that. Do you think it makes you look less crazy?
No.
Oh. Anyway, a big thank you, exclamation mark, goes to our latest Patreon supporters. Who are they, Dominic?
Lucy Davis, Gavin McLean, Adeline, Emily Gallagher, and Clariette Ball. Thank you all. You can join this crew by heading to patreon.com/Europeans podcast and contributing from as little as 2 smackers a month.
For some reason, I recently stumbled across the fact that May 24th, next Monday, is a national holiday in 2 European countries, Bulgaria and North Macedonia, celebrating the Cyrillic script. Cyrillic, of course, being the writing system that is used in loads of different countries in Eastern Europe, including Bulgaria and North Macedonia, but also Russia and Serbia and Ukraine. I'm not going to name them all, or we'll be here all day. It's also used widely in Central Asia. And I've always been slightly fascinated by Cyrillic writing. Because it looks cool and I can't read it. I guess I'm kind of guilty of exoticizing it, really.
You are, yes.
Sorry. But this national holiday celebrating this writing system, it felt like a pretty great excuse to find out a little bit more about how Cyrillic works and why it has its own public holiday celebrating it. And why, actually, interestingly, some countries are trying to phase it out because of its colonial associations. And we have the perfect guest to tell you all about it, Maria Duroli and Krista Radoeva. They are both typography designers. Maria is originally from Russia, Krista is from Bulgaria. And they are the co-founders of a very cool project called Cyrillixy, which I think is an amazing pun. It's a pun on the word seriously, which I didn't initially realise.
Oh my God, I didn't realise that either until you just mentioned it. That's really genius.
I love it. And what Maria and Krista do is they teach fellow designers from all over the world to use Cyrillic and about its history. So we thought we'd ring them up for a little crash course. What do we know about how this form of writing, Cyrillic, was invented in general?
Well, it's a very interesting story in general to have like origin story for a script, like compared to some of the more much older scripts where you don't really know what exactly happened and how they were made. For Cyrillic, you can kind of pinpoint the authors of it even. The common misconception is that they are these two saints, Cyril and Methodius, and that they created Cyrillic. But that's actually not true. It is in fact that they created an earlier version of a script that was made for the Slavic languages, which is like the Glagolitic script. And that one didn't really like catch on. Well, it didn't become very popular. So afterwards, the students of Cyril and Methodius, they used the analysis of the language and they used the Cyril and Methodius research and they created the Cyrillic script, which was partially based on Greek, but also inventing some new letters. And that was around like 850, 868 in that kind of a period.
Aha. And so can someone who reads Cyrillic today read something that was written in the 9th century, or would it be completely incomprehensible?
Of course, we can still like recognize the letter and maybe kind of like guess the meaning, but of course language changed and like it's not the same as just like reading a book. It will be very slow and hard to read and understand.
And why exactly was there a need for a new script to be invented?
Well, the ancient Bulgarian and the old Slavonic languages, they were using Greek. So they didn't have an actual writing system for their own language. And it was the idea of one of the Bulgarian kings that they needed to separate themselves as like national identity. And he thought that one of the most important things for a national identity is to have its own writing system.
Well, Cyrillic definitely would be very hard for me and Katie to read, and it looks rather intimidating. I sometimes sing in languages that use Cyrillic, but we always transliterate it, we cheat. I've heard it's actually not that difficult to learn. Is that true?
So compared to English, I think it's quite easy because, as you say that you transliterate things, that is because it is phonetic. So because of that early analysis that they did on the language, they figure out how many exact characters they need for the sounds of the language. So it's kind of like a what you see is what you get, a script. And in that sense, at least the letters, I think, are easy-ish to learn. The languages are maybe a different story.
And so you guys are from different countries. Krista, you are from and in Bulgaria. Maria, you are originally from Russia. Do you guys use different types of Cyrillic? Like, can you read each other's Cyrillic perfectly or not?
We can.
Well, they can recognize the letters for sure and they can read it. But the language has changed quite a lot. And it's also very different because like a 9th century Cyrillic is like a Old Church Slavonic or ancient Bulgarian language, which is the basis for all of the other languages that are nowadays use Cyrillic, like Bulgarian, Russian, Serbian, Macedonian, etc. So it would be also very different how all these languages evolved. And I think if Bulgarians read it, they might understand certain things. And then if Russians read it, they might actually understand other things.
In recent years, several former Soviet countries, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Mongolia, have announced that they're going to try and shift away from using Cyrillic, which is a pretty big decision that will cause a lot of disruption for ordinary people, potentially creating huge problems with literacy and other things. Is this script seen as something colonial by some of the countries that still use it?
There was a period of time in Soviet times when everybody, all of these countries were united. And of course, it was like complicated and it might have created even more confusion in the sense that nowadays in like many of these countries, it's common to know like Latin, Cyrillic, and for example, Arabic too. And of course, it is a complicated situation. And nowadays, many of these countries tend more towards Europe. So it's kind of like this logical solution to just switch to this same script. I think it is a lot of politics involved, but of course, for like many people who are, for example, still speaking like Russian in Kazakhstan, it will be harder to get used to a new script.
From our perspective, like, I think it's sad when politics get too much involved in decisions like this. It's a similar case in Eastern Europe between like Serbia, Macedonia, and Croatia. And in those countries also, officially, it used to be only Cyrillic. And then it has in recent years becomes even like a political statement to which script you're actually using to write, because you can write in both. Whether you write with Latin or Cyrillic, it's a question of what kind of a politics you support.
Interesting. I did not know that. You guys actually teach fellow designers from all over the world to use Cyrillic. And I'd never thought before about the fact that typefaces are often designed by people that don't necessarily know how to read them. Is it quite a common experience for people from the Cyrillic using part of the world to have to use fonts that aren't actually that readable or that well designed for them?
Well, type design used to be at least much more developed in Western Europe and in the US. So naturally, a lot of type design and a lot of Cyrillic used to come from foreigners to begin with. But I think that's also changing in recent years. But it is common that these days to make a typeface, like a big family that would cover many languages. And for that, you have a choice. You can either do it like yourself in-house and you can have native consultants to do that, or you can hire somebody like us to design it, to design the Cyrillic version for in addition to the Latin or all the other scripts. So there are many options, but since the interest in Cyrillic has grown so much, it was one of the reasons why we started teaching it. Because I think it is important since it is being made. For us, it's like an opportunity to provide information in English, to make it available for more people, and to, in a way, help improve the quality of it.
So I read that the Bulgarian government put a monument to the Cyrillic alphabet on an island in Antarctica.
I read about that too. It was a few years ago.
Yeah. And why do you think the script is so important to Bulgarian culture that they did something like that?
It's a matter of national pride. I mean, it originated from Bulgaria and we like making a point of that. And there is nothing wrong in celebrating that. I think actually it was made in collaboration with the Mongolian Antarctica expedition as well as the Bulgarian one. And I think it's also related to something that we were talking about earlier, like Mongolia being one of the countries that is now switching to Latin. And I've read that before that they kind of made a lot of efforts to link Cyrillic to Bulgaria rather than to link it to the Russian influence. So it was just trying to make different kind of connections, I guess.
Very controversial question to finish on. Do you guys think that Cyrillic is a more beautiful script or has more fun possibilities as designers than the Latin alphabet?
Well, in a way, I think it depends on how exactly you approach it. In many ways, it's still very much evolving. So you can try out much more things. You can experiment more. You can do things that people will say that it's not common, it's not how it should be, but too I think it contributes to a variety of possibilities that you have. Cyrillic, it's still hundreds, so you have a lot more freedom and a lot more like job to do that, and I think that is a very exciting part.
In our workshops, people are designing a Cyrillic version of their own Latin typeface. But during that process, they often discover that after drawing Cyrillic, they would change things in their Latin too. And I think it's a very exciting opportunity to, when you're working on a few scripts at the same time, for them to influence each other. And so that they are working together rather than one being just an afterthought of the other.
If you are like me and you love pleasingly designed things, especially nice typography, you should follow Krista and Maria online. You will find the links in the show notes.
We could not let this episode go without a bit of Eurovision chat. So I'm taking over Isolation Inspiration for Eurovision because it's back after a year off due to you know what.
Yes, finally.
It's so exciting and it's taking place in Rotterdam, a city tantalizingly close to my hometown of Amsterdam. And there is actually an audience, which is kind of weird. It's part of the Dutch government's testing for entrance scheme, whereby a few thousand people are allowed to watch the performances and rehearsals live if they show proof of a negative COVID test on entry.
Why haven't you got a ticket?
Yeah, I know. I didn't really want to risk it. It takes place at the absolutely enormous Ahoy Arena, and they're using only a fraction of the possible audience capacity. Oh, and actually, a little aside, last year they used the Ahoy Arena as a spillover COVID hospital. So I know people will have mixed views about whether or not we're at the stage where a venue like this should be used for thousands of people in the audience. But I think we can all agree that it's great that it's not being needed to be used as a hospital spillover venue.
It does seem like quite nice symbolism to have it replaced with Eurovision, aka the best and funnest event in the world.
Yeah, I agree. It's pretty exciting. Who are you rooting for, Katie?
Well, France and Italy are the kind of front runners, aren't they?
They are, although it's still pretty open, according to the bookies.
France's entry is a singer called Barbara Pravi. She's Franco-Serbian, I think, and she's a really good songwriter. She's written for loads of other people. And her song is called Voila, and it's kind of low-key and beautiful.
It's a bit Edith Piaf-esque, isn't it?
Yeah, it's got this sort of chanson française slash power ballad thing going on. So that's kind of fun. The other front runner is Italy. It's this band called Maneskin. If you're around in the mid-noughties, they kind of remind me of The Hives. That's kind of cool to see a rocky act do so well. It's quite unusual.
And at the moment, they really are the number one favourites, which I'm really surprised about. Sometimes I'm just like, what is going on? Why is this band and this song so popular? It just sounds like a really generic, if charismatic, rock number with loads of pyrotechnics.
Maybe it's like solidarity with Italy after COVID. I don't know. Who are your actual personal favourites?
Well, I am still in love with the Iceland entry. It's the same band that applied last year and would have won last year and probably won't win this year because the song isn't quite as good as their song last year, but
yeah,
they're still kind of up there, number four in the bookies' favorites at the time of recording. So I'm just keeping my fingers crossed because I think they're so lovely and charming and geeky, and I actually think the music's really good.
Yeah, I like it too. The one I like best for comedy value is Ukraine, because the video just has like so many good Eurovision tropes combined. It's this quite gothic looking band, all wearing black, and they're like standing in a moody looking forest, and the singer has this like ridiculous metal robot thing attached to her head, and it's quite rocky, but then one of the band members is just playing like a really aggressive tin whistle for some reason.
It's a very strange video.
I love it.
And I know there are a lot of Eurovision haters still out there, even amongst European listeners, and I get it. We were both relatively late converts and a lot of the music is rubbish, but some of the music isn't rubbish and a lot of the performances are joyously entertaining. And yeah, I think this competition celebrates Europe in all its diversity, its queerness, its silliness and its seriousness. And I think that's wonderful.
Did you see that Eurovision is going to America?
No.
Yeah, they're starting Eurovision US. It's going to be a state-by-state competition.
But is it still going to be called Eurovision?
I don't know. It's a very good question. But yeah, America, you're welcome. We have just gifted you the greatest cultural offering that Europe has to offer. I don't think it's going to feel like half as camp and weird as our version, and therefore it will be less fun. But I'm obviously going to watch it.
Oh yeah, me too. And in fact, one of our Patreon supporters recommended an absolutely brilliant BBC World Service radio documentary about Eurovision. It's from a few years ago, 2016, I think, which I listened to yesterday, and it made me love Eurovision even more than I do already. It's called The Swedish Ambassador's Guide to Eurovision, and it's made by an actual Swedish ambassador to London who explores Eurovision's history of not just reflecting politics, but also affecting it. It's really worth listening to whilst you're getting ready for your Eurovision viewing this weekend. We'll put a link in the show notes.
Just Googled it, by the way. The American version is going to be called the American Song Contest.
Ah, that's boring.
Boring!
Happy news this week comes from the Republic of Ireland, where there was the first sighting of a pair of cranes nesting in the country in over 300 years.
Wow.
These big, long-legged, long-necked birds have a wingspan of over 2 meters and were once pretty common in Ireland and had a significant place in Irish folklore, but they died out due to foxes hunting them and humans even hunting them. It's pretty extraordinary that they are back, and it's being put down to the fact that this particular site, a peat bog, has been re-wetted. Shout out to producer Katz Laszlo, who is a big fan of peat bogs and talks about them all the time.
That's weird.
It is a bit, and really charming as well. Cranes have been seen sporadically on the island of Ireland, but this is the first time that they've been seen during breeding season. This doesn't necessarily mean we'll be seeing lots of baby cranes all of a sudden. The chief ecologist of the company that owns the land said to the BBC that he was quite optimistic that they will eventually produce offspring, but that it might take a few goes, so a few years. We'll keep our fingers crossed, but yay for the cranes coming back to Ireland.
That's it for this week. We need to go and get ready for Eurovision. I am so excited it's back. And also, if you're watching this weekend, and frankly, why wouldn't you be watching? You should tag us in your posts and tweets. I think I might attempt some live tweeting from our account on the night. You can find us on Twitter at EuropeansPod. We're also on Instagram and Facebook under Europeans Podcast.
Thank you so much to our producers, Andrei Popovicu, Priyanka Shankar and Katz Laszlo. We are part of the Are We Europe family of podcasts. You can go and check out all their other offerings at areweeurope.com/audio-family. We'll be back next week with an episode with a little less chatter from us and a bit more chatter from a father and son duo in Italy who will be telling us their extraordinary parallel coming of age story as part of our new mini-series, This Is What a Generation Sounds Like. We're very excited to play this story for you. We think it's something really special. We hope you like it. Don't worry, Good Week, Bad Week will be back the week after, but we highly recommend you don't skip next week's episode, even if you miss Katie and me a little bit.
Why would they miss us? We're rubbish.
Yeah, good question.
See you next week, everyone.
Bye.
Boke.